thought the Darley Routier case would be a good first installment of We the Jury, since I knew very little about it, and I thought we might take this journey together. How many times in your life have you asked yourself, what if? Well, that's what I'm asking you to do today, because even after researching, reading, and watching all the various documentaries, I still can't say that I have a definitive 100% stance on guilt or innocence. I mean, could Darley have killed her children, then slashed herself and staged a crime scene? I suppose it's possible. But isn't it also possible that it really was an unknown intruder, as Darley says? I think there are too many oddities in the state's theory that raise reasonable doubt. So, what if? What if she really is innocent? And if I found this much reasonable doubt, how did it progress to the point that Darley has been on death row for more than 20 years? But let's see what your thoughts are. I'll present to you some of the factors used against Darley, and I'd like to know if you would have voted to convict or acquit. There's no denying that a horrific crime took place in the early morning hours of June 6, 1996, in the city of Rowlett, Texas. It was absolutely tragic. Two small kids and their mother were violently attacked in their home. The children, Devin, who was 5, and Damon, 6, both died from their stab wounds, while their mother, Darley Routier, survived her injuries, which included a slash to her throat that just missed her carotid artery. On the night of the crime, the boys had asked to camp out in the living room. Darley, wanting to keep an eye on her kids, decided to sleep in the living room as well, while her husband, Darren, and their 8-month-old baby stayed upstairs. Now, according to Darley, she woke up with an unknown man inside their home. At that point, she says that she ran after the intruder, and as she followed, she picked up a knife she saw lying on the floor. The knife felt wet, so she turned on the light, and that's when she saw that her children were hurt. She began screaming for her husband, who came downstairs and tried to perform CPR on Devin, but it was already too late. Darley called 911, and it was from this call that police began to focus solely on Darley for the murder of her boys.
911, what is your emergency?
Ma'am?
One of the things that Darley said during her 911 call was that she picked up the knife and therefore may have ruined any fingerprints on the knife. Investigators deemed that suspicious, saying what kind of person thinks about fingerprints as her kids lie dying in the same room? Out of context, sure, that might seem suspicious, and it's my opinion that police did exactly that. They framed that statement out of context, especially to the media. The actual conversation with the dispatcher went more like this. As Darley was speaking to an officer that had arrived on the scene, she tells him to go look in the garage, that they left a knife laying on the floor, and the dispatcher cuts in and says, "There's a knife, don't touch anything." It's at that point that Darley makes the so-called incriminating statement. She says that she, quote, already touched it and picked it up, then says, quote, "His knife was laying over there, and I already picked it up. God, I bet if we could have gotten the prints, maybe..." To me, it sounded like she was trying to preserve the evidence to catch the killer. Remember, there's not one way to act when trauma occurs, and everyone's mind works differently. I would also like to point out that after 2 minutes and 59 seconds, Darley asks, "When are they going to be here?" meaning the ambulance. To you and me, 3 minutes might not be very long, but when you're waiting for help, it seems like forever. She wasn't just waiting patiently. She was frantic and panicked and wanted help now. I was a 911 dispatcher, and it's very difficult to assure callers that help is on the way. On their end, it feels like an eternity. One of the points of evidence the prosecution used against Darley were the wounds that she sustained during the attack. They deemed them self-inflicted and superficial. Darley had some pretty severe injuries, but medically, they would be called superficial. One doctor's testimony was that the wounds were very serious, but he used the words, quote, "The neck wound came within 2 millimeters of the carotid sheath, but was superficial to the carotid artery." He clarifies that the word superficial here means on the surface or shallow, as opposed to deep. So for your reference, keep in mind that your cornea is on the superficial surface to your eye. So while the word superficial might sound insignificant, it's actually really serious. However, prosecutors focused only on the word superficial. The sheath that protects the carotid artery was actually damaged, but because it's on the surface, it's considered superficial. The prosecution also consistently persisted on the word possible throughout the trial. They often say, "But isn't it possible?" Of course, those testifying must answer, "Yes, it's possible." But they usually follow up with the phrase, "But not probable." At one point, a defense witness is asked by prosecutors if it was impossible for Darley to have inflicted these wounds on herself. The doctor replies that he isn't saying it's impossible, but what he is saying is that based on their location and path, that it's improbable. It's also important to note that Darley is right-handed and her neck wound was made with a left-handed motion. Furthermore, one juror that was interviewed during the documentary, Waiting for a Miracle, which you can see on YouTube, said that if he had seen all of the photos of Darley's injuries, he would have voted not guilty. He stated that it was clear to him these injuries were not self-inflicted. It's statements like these that make me so mad about our adversarial justice system. Prosecutors would rather win than allow jurors to make a true assessment of the evidence. Why not just lay all the facts out? Additionally, there were 12 unidentified prints found at the scene, two of which were bloody fingerprints. I think the defense team may still be conducting some testing on these prints, but my question is, why wouldn't the prosecution have conducted this testing on their own? Why should the defense have to fight to test evidence? In any case, a judge had granted permission to run these particular prints, but the state opposed it for 9 years. These prints don't belong to Darley or to Darren or their boys. So, who do the prints belong to? Remember, two of them are bloody prints, so they came from somebody at that crime scene. Another piece of evidence the prosecution used to convict Darley was the fact that there was blood under a broken glass. Darley told police that she heard glass break as she was chasing the intruder. However, there's a bloody footprint under the broken glass, showing that the glass broke after Darley walked through that area. The defense countered that when emergency crews arrived, the scene became chaotic. There were 3 bloody victims, and the priority was to save them. It's probable that the emergency workers, or Darley, or Darren, could have jostled a piece of glass so that it moved on to the footprint. Remember, this is a scene where several people are consistently moving about in almost a frenzied state. Each person that arrives on the scene has the potential to contaminate that scene. Also incriminating was the fact that there were particles consistent with the cut screen on a bread knife in the Routier home. Prosecutors say this proved Darley cut that screen herself to stage a crime scene. However, it was determined that cross-contamination could easily have taken place while dusting for prints. In this instance, it was discovered that the knife block had been dusted for prints before the forensic examination determining the screen particles were present. They say the particles could have transferred from the print brush. After further digging, I found a document from a forensic consultant hired by Darley's first defense attorney. In it, he stated that he recommended further testing be conducted on the brush and the particles to substantiate or dispute the state's theory. He also stated that in his professional opinion, the crime scene was not staged. I'm not sure why, but Darley's trial defense team didn't call this guy to testify. Once police develop tunnel vision or focus on just one suspect, they tend to fit the evidence to their narrative rather than the other way around. Tunnel vision is a common factor in wrongful convictions. In this case, there were reports of a suspicious black car in the neighborhood. A neighbor reported to police that she saw the driver of this car looking at the Routier home twice before the crime occurred, including the day of. And there's no evidence that police even followed up on that report. Neither Darren nor Darley's cars were in their driveway the night of the murders, so their house appeared vacant. Pretty tempting for a burglar, wouldn't you say? Another clue that police didn't thoroughly investigate was a sock found in an alleyway several yards from the scene. An athletic sock that was smeared with the boy's blood was found near a storm drain in an alley 75 yards from the Routier's house. It looked as though someone had tossed it toward the drain but missed. The state theorized that Darley dabbed the sock in her son's blood, then ran 75 yards to the alley to toss the sock to make it appear as though an intruder did so. Then she ran the 75 yards back to the house. So let's break that down. First, if Darley was trying to plant the sock, why wouldn't she have done so where she would be sure the police would find it? Like in her own yard? Furthermore, why even do so with a sock and not the murder weapon? Then there's the timeline issue. Her sons were both severely injured. Devin had died at the scene, and the medical examiner testified that Damon could not have lived more than 6 or 7 minutes after he was stabbed. It's not physically possible for Darley to have stabbed the boys, dabbed the sock in blood, ran the 150 yards to the alley and back, staged the scene, slashed herself, and then called 911 before Damon would have passed away. As a matter of fact, Damon died on the way to the hospital in the back of the ambulance. It's not physically possible, but police refused to focus on anyone but Darley. At trial, the prosecution also told the jury that the dust on the windowsill where the alleged intruder entered was undisturbed. Further, they said, the mulch in the flower bed under the window was also undisturbed. Darren brought a television crew to their home and demonstrated his ability to climb into and out of the very large ground-level window without touching the sill. He then showed the TV crew that the flower bed was about 6 or 7 feet from the window in question, so there would be no reason for that mulch to be disturbed. Instead, there's concrete under that window. The defense team did make sure the jury was aware of the correct facts regarding the dusty windowsill and the mulch, but they still voted to convict Darley. Investigators also found a blonde hair in the track of the window where the cut screen was. After analyzing the hair, it was determined that it had characteristics matching Darley's, meaning it was bleach blonde with untreated roots. The analyst testified at her bail hearing that the hair was forcibly removed and it was a match to Darley's hair, giving credence to the prosecution's theory that Darley was the one that cut the screen and not an intruder. But since Darley lived there, wouldn't you think that her hair would naturally be all over that house? But she was denied bail. At trial, that same analyst testified that they conducted further testing on the hair, and it was determined to belong to a female police officer. How did a forcibly removed hair from a police officer get in that track? We'll probably never know, but what we can determine is that the crime scene was contaminated, and it also provides further proof that microscopic hair analysis is junk science. Speaking of bleach blonde hair, I'll now discuss the potential reason why Darlie Routier was really convicted. She was a victim of character assassination. Because Darlie was a bubbly, bleach blonde girl with breast implants, the jury didn't like her. Unfortunately, the defense asked for and was granted a change of venue, but the trial was moved to a conservative town that had a 95% conviction rate, and they didn't take too kindly to Darlie. All of her friends and family considered Darlie to be a great mom, but because she liked a lavish lifestyle and had nice things, the prosecution portrayed her as materialistic and self-centered. One juror interviewed for The Last Defense, which you can see on abc.com, said, quote, "Who goes out and spends $2,000 on a set of breasts? That was one of the things that really caught our attention," unquote. First of all, how did that person even get on this jury? And second, how are fake breasts evidence of murder? Okay, I suppose I should mention that the prosecution said that Darlie was so vain that when she cut herself, she took special care not to damage her fake breasts. Never mind, though, that she's going to have this very visible scar on her neck for the rest of her life. Anyway, this juror mentions that throughout the trial, glamorous photos of Darlie were shown with her in flashy clothes and expensive jewelry. The juror also says, quote, "I don't buy any of that stuff, but she bought a lot of it." Again, I'm not sure how that's evidence of murder, but the juror made sure to add that, quote, "the way she lived doesn't make her a killer, but it sure does bring suspicion," unquote. I ask you, how does that bring suspicion to a person? In addition to her breasts, her clothes, and her jewelry, the jury felt the final straw for them was that Darlie was inappropriate at the boys' gravesite. Family and friends had gathered to celebrate what should have been Damon's 7th birthday. During this celebration, a TV crew captured footage of Darlie smiling and spraying silly string near the grave. Darlie's family suggested the party, and her sister brought the silly string, knowing that Damon loved it. That video was approximately 15 seconds long, and it sealed Darlie's fate. The jury watched it over and over again, and that same juror who spoke out about Darlie's lifestyle called this graveside behavior, quote, "repulsive." And I'll bet if you remember anything at all about this case, it's that video. What the jury did not see or hear was the somber service before that. Police illegally bugged the gravesite in hopes that they would catch a confession, but because the recording was illegally obtained, it wasn't played at trial. A juror admitted that had he heard that recording, he would have voted to acquit. So, should someone's image be used as evidence? How about how they grieve? There was plenty of physical evidence in this case, so why even resort to that tactic? Scary that this could happen to any of us, right? So, after all this time, please ask yourself, what if? What if Darlie really is innocent and on death row?